You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Tom Michael, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on all the news that made headlines this week around the region. So we're going to jump right in. Our guests today are Kevin Richard of Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp with KIVI, Six on Your Side, and Scott McIntosh of the Idaho Press. And we're glad to have the Avengers assembled for this endgame. So on Tuesday afternoon, we'll jump right in here. Tuesday afternoon, we heard Frankie Barnhill's story about the new Boise State University president, Marlene Tromp, the school's first female president. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what else is interesting about her?
Well, Marlene, not Melania. Tromp, not Trump. Okay, you know, I haven't tweeted that yet. I haven't said that in the story yet, and I've jinxed myself. So my takeaways from Tuesday afternoon were, first of all, the enthusiasm that you saw in the room. I mean, this is the Stickle Sky Center. It seats about 200 people. It was filled pretty much to capacity with students, staff, faculty, who interrupted the state board meeting to applaud when Trump's name was mentioned, when she was nominated for the presidency. I mean,
we certainly heard that on the tape shared, support from the university community.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever seen a State Board of Education meeting that lasted only 3 minutes counting a break for applause. I mean, people were really enthusiastic about it, and I don't think it's just a sense of closure, because let's face it, it's been a 17-month process for the university to find a new president. I think there's genuine enthusiasm that, you know, she brings a new perspective. You mentioned that she's the first female president at the university. She's a little bit younger than your typical university president.
52.
But I also was struck by her personal story, which I think will resonate with a lot of Idaho parents and a lot of Idaho students. She's a first-generation college student, college graduate. She talked about when she was a high school student that she was overwhelmed by the process of applying for college. She couldn't even do the application. She was so overwhelmed. A guidance counselor took over and filled out the applications on her behalf, paid the fees on her behalf, and she eventually did wind up going to college. Her father had some reservations, so her father made her pledge to go to a college within a day's drive of Green River, Wyoming. And there isn't a whole lot within a day's drive of Green River, Oregon, Wyoming, but she found a college to do her undergrad work and went on. And talked about how that's really, you know, it's reminded her of the need. Sometimes you just need a champion or an advocate to make that leap to go to college. And, you know, I think she realizes at the macro level, this is a state that's had a lot of challenges getting high school graduates to continue their education and then to see it through, to complete college. So I think she gets it from a personal perspective. I was really struck by that.
Great backstory, of course. Institution she worked at, Santa Cruz and Arizona State.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So a KIVI story that caught our eye, a new facility in Caldwell that you characterized, Mike, as an alternative to a jail and to emergency room. Those seem like different institutions. how are they connected?
Well, I, without getting too personal, I've been in a situation. I was close to a crisis situation. Mm-hmm. So I was never in need of a crisis center. But I can tell you, when you're in that situation and you don't quite need an ER, that's not going to help you. And you're not to a spot where you're going to commit these crimes. There's no real place for you. And so what Canyon County has done, and it's the Western Idaho Crisis Center, and it serves a lot of the counties in the surrounding area, it enables for 24 hours somebody to get their head right without getting to a spot where maybe they become suicidal, without getting to a spot where maybe they commit a crime. They're able to be honest with themselves and kind of put themselves in a safe space and enable themselves to breathe. They have quiet rooms. They have these counselors and people who are going to be there to just kind of watch over them. I remember when I was, a reporter back in 2013, I interviewed then Sheriff Gary Rainey, and the story stuck with me. He told me about this woman who was in the Ada County Jail at that time who had assaulted multiple guards. And when they finally talked to her family, she shared with them that they needed to go get her teddy bear, because if she has her teddy bear, she doesn't get violent. And he said, that woman does not belong in prison. That woman does not belong in jail. She needs something else. And the goal of this facility is to keep somebody like that from getting to a spot where they commit a crime or they do something to themselves and give them a first resort.
That's really a solution meets the problem. I was really intrigued what the governor said, quote, what was taking place before was almost opposite of what needed to take place.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you think about what happens. I mean, we are trusting our police officers to do a lot of work. It's already a difficult enough job. Trusting them to have to learn how to be counselors and therapists and deal with a myriad of mental issues. It's just not something that is practical, and it's not something that is economical for the state. The state and the counties are paying for this all over the place. You see, they're the ones who end up footing the bill for a lot of these programs, whether it be jail or if they end up in some of these emergency facilities. So the goal would be foot the money now. They funded it, I think, out 2 years. And hopefully it'll save some lives.
As you said, under 24 hours, 23 hours and 59 minutes.
Exactly.
Certain. Scott.
And that's why they were created. So this is one of seven centers across the state. And I think this is the sixth one that's been created. And the idea is to divert these patients away from the criminal justice system and out of the ERs around the state to save some money. And they're finding with the other centers that it is indeed saving money in the long run.
Well, and we were talking the last time I was in here about the shortage of psychiatrists and psychologists in the state of Idaho. And I think that's a big – when you call and you're in that desperate situation, it may take a month or a month and a half to get an appointment at a counselor that you trust. So this enables somebody to kind of skip that line. Or let's say you finally get in 6 weeks later. It takes 6 weeks to get that medication to really affect you. You're talking 12 weeks that you're in a dangerous situation. So hopefully this is a spot where people can go. You just have to get the word out and hope that people can kind of trust this as a safety net.
If you're just joining us, this is Idaho Matters, and it's our reporters' roundtable. You know, Kevin, something else the legislature did accomplish this year was to raise minimum teacher salary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lot of press on that. So maybe who benefits and how this shakes out exactly?
Well, with the help of our data analyst, Randy Schrader, we were able to dig in and see how many teachers we're talking about and where those teachers are. And it comes to right now, there are more than 3,600 teachers across the state that are making less than $40,000 a year. So they're in line to get basically an automatic pay raise over the next 2 years as the state increases its minimum salary from $35,800 to the $40,000 mark that it will get to in 2 years. And it was interesting to me to get a sense of where some of these teachers are.
Let me guess, mostly rural places?
There are some rural districts that have maybe half or more of their teachers making less than $40,000 a year. PayEd is a good example where they have a lot of teachers under $40,000. But they also have a lot of teachers that are making more than $50,000 a year, and they're trying to figure out what to do to help those teachers and get raises for them. The hotspot, I guess, if you will, the district that has the most teachers making less than $40,000 a year right now is Nampa, which is the third largest district in the state, ahead of West Ada, well ahead of Boise. And that's really not a surprise that Boise's numbers are fairly low. Boise's teacher salaries have tended to skew higher for a lot of years, and that's been kind of an ongoing issue in the Treasure Valley of teachers working a few years in one of the outlying school districts, getting a job in Boise where the pay is higher. I think what's really interesting now to watch is just how does this play itself out in terms of it should help, you would imagine, teacher recruitment. It should help smaller districts recruit beginning teachers, but the retention and trying to pay teachers and keep teachers in the classroom and keep teachers in some of these smaller districts, that's going to be an ongoing challenge. A minimum salary doesn't really help you there. It's what I heard from administrators and union folks is this is a step to make it easier for the state to recruit and retain teachers, but it's not a cure-all.
And in your reporting, we certainly hear about some of those rural areas where administrators are just trying to recruit, and that's always a challenge.
It's always a challenge. I talked to one administrator in Malad in the Oneida School District, and he says, you know, look, I go to job fairs in Utah where the minimum salary is several thousand dollars a year, more than I can offer. And they offer a bit above the state minimum as it is. He says, the teachers just laugh at us. There's no incentive for them to cross the border unless I can find a teacher a candidate who has some tie to the area. Mm. I mean, that's about their only hope.
Scott, maybe you could help us unpack what the step this is at. These are two proposed 2020 ballot initiatives this week, minimum wage and medical marijuana. Where are they now in terms of process?
Right. So the Attorney General's office reviewed both initiative proposals, and that's kind of a first step. And the Attorney General's office kind of gave the green light to the minimum wage initiative. The minimum wage initiative would increase the minimum wage from the current $7.25 an hour, which matches the federal minimum wage, and then would increase it gradually over 4 years to $12 an hour by 2024. And the Attorney General's office reviewed the initiative, said, yep, this looks fine. There's no constitutional issues with it. You can go ahead and start collecting signatures. So we could start seeing folks out on the street collecting signatures to be put on the November 2020 ballot. The other measure on medical marijuana had some issues with the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office said that one of the main problems with this initiative is that it's not single subject. So any ballot measure that comes up on the ballot has to be a single subject. And the wording of the medical marijuana initiative had two distinct motions. One is to legalize medical marijuana and one was to legalize hemp. And so the Attorney General's office says, no, you can't really do both of those at once. You have to split those out. There were some other minor issues and unconstitutionally vague language. So that's going back to those organizers. And it's worth noting that if these measures do attempt to get on the ballot, they will be under those current standards that
55,000 registered voters,
right.
18 of 35 districts, those standards to hurdle.
Right, because Governor Little, of course, vetoed the legislation that would have made it more difficult. So those were the standards that got Prop 1 and Prop 2 on the ballot last year.
And just before break, speaking of marijuana, it looks like legal marijuana is not something Governor Brad Little supports. He said something at Capitol for a day in Emmett. What did he say?
Right. He said if Idahoans wanted legal marijuana, they elected the wrong guy. He said that at the Capitol for a day. I'm personally very glad that Governor Little is continuing the Capitol for a day. For anyone who's been to a Capitol for a day, I really think it's one of the best things that the state government does. But he made it very clear, yep, I'm not your guy. I'm not going to support legal marijuana. In fact, he said that he thinks that folks are moving here because they're trying to get away from all these other states mm-hmm. that have marijuana.
Standing there in Emmett, which is about an hour drive from the nearest dispensary in Huntington, Oregon. I'm Tom Michael, and here today, Reporter Roundtable. Kevin Richard of Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp, KIVI6 on your side, and Scott McIntosh, the Idaho Press. Well, nothing drives headlines like politics, art and politics. It's kind of an age-old story. An artist ticks off an elected official with something that they've made. But Kevin, the latest story involves students and the Wood River Valley. Maybe take us to that.
Yeah, I mean, it involves art. It involves politics. You throw in some student expression, some free speech issues. You have kind of a made-for-internet story. So for several years, students at Wood River High School have painted tiles on the ceilings of the building. And they're asked, it's an elective assignment, and it's been an AP assignment. They're asked to paint something that's occurred over the past year that's resonated with them, something about a current event of one kind or another. Several of the ceiling tiles depict anti-Trump messages, and that got the attention of a former legislative candidate from Jerome, who posted some of the photos on her Facebook page and urged her friends and her followers to contact the state, contact the school district, contact State Superintendent Shuri Ibarra.
And by the way, this story did flame up on the internet.
It certainly did. It certainly took off on the internet and certainly took over, took on a life of its own on social media, to the point where the chairman of the House Education Committee, Lance Clough, sent an email to the superintendent of the Blaine County School District to ask, well, what's going on up here? Her response was to say again that this has been going on for several years. The students are asked to take on a current event of one kind or another, and then they're asked to explain what they were trying to say and to kind of justify the message that they were trying to convey through art. And she said, we've seen paintings all across the political spectrum. One praising President Trump for trying to get rid of government regulations. And she attached that image to her email response to Representative Clow, along with one that she said was her personal favorite, a tile of Abraham Lincoln.
And the question raised, well, why are these legislators and administrators even commenting on this press?
Right. And then it becomes a question of student expression. And do you allow a free form of student expression wherever that goes and wherever that ends up going or not? And I think that became a big part of the debate that's unfolding on social media and continues to unfold on our Facebook page. I mean, it's, you know, obviously, it's one of those stories that gets people very stirred up on both sides. A lot of back and forth. I don't know if many minds have been changed in the debate, but certainly a lot of debate about, you know, free expression in schools.
Mike, just yesterday, this station launched You Know the Place, about finding quirky places throughout the region. And there are institutions in Boise called, let's say, Boise High for musicians, billed as a safe, sober space that offers mental health services. And you had a story this week about the Phoenix Gym in Boise. What do they offer in addition to just working out?
Yeah, so over the last year, we have a franchise called Finding Hope, where we've dug into that opioid epidemic that's in pretty much every community. And this was Karen Lair's most recent report, where there's this gym that specifically attracts recovering addicts. And I mean, some of them are from jails. Some of them are just people who are maybe 24. You have to be at least 48 hours sober. So you show up, you get to meet a new network of people outside of maybe your network of friends who may be part of the problem, right? A lot of people get out of jail and they go back to that same life and they meet this talk to the same people and they end up doing the same things. This enables you to create a new network, feel safe, build those friendships in a unique way. And also, I mean, you're doing one of the more healthy behaviors, which is, you know, exercise and getting your workout on. So
and people have gym buddies, so this might be also part of that camaraderie.
Exactly. And I think anybody, you know, who knows somebody who's been in recovery, a lot of times you do get paired up with somebody who is kind of your mentor to help you through that process. And not only do they get a workout with this person, but they also have a friend who they can turn to when maybe things get hard.
And dopamines and all those kind of natural stimulants that happen when you work out. Scott, the Idaho Press had an investigative story about a couple. You know, their names weren't printed in the newspaper, but they spent $5,000 in calls with prison inmates at Ada County Jail. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So maybe you could describe the iceberg for us.
Yeah, sure. So Ada County has ceased in-person jail visits for the past several years, and they've replaced it with phone calls and video chats as a service to the inmates to talk with family members. Now, inmates can talk to clergy members and attorneys in person, of course, but if they want to call a friend or family member, they have to use this phone call or video chat service. And the inmates are charged for this. So they're charged at Ada County Jail 25 cents per minute by this private company that Ada County contracts with called Telmate. And what we found out was that over the past several years, Ada County has been generating about $500,000, $500,000 per year on these calls.
That's an enormous number.
Yeah. And according to their contract with Telmate, they receive 25% of the revenues. So that would suggest that this is generating $2 million in revenues. And this is on the backs of what a lot of people say are the people who can least afford to pay these charges. This is not an Ada County alone situation. This is not even in Idaho. This is across the country. And in fact, the New York Times at one point said that this was a $1.2 billion industry across the country. And I think that's even low because just last year, one company was sold for $1.5 billion. So that one company alone was valued at $1.5 billion. So you're talking a lot of money. And you're talking a lot of money that's coming out of the pockets of people who are in, you know, the worst part of their lives in jail for something that they are accused, sometimes just accused of doing something wrong. So this is somebody who might have been arrested and charged with something, but they haven't been convicted yet. They can't make bond because they can't afford it. And so they're in jail. And the only way to talk to their friends and family are by these phone calls.
Our society used to different upcharges when you go to something like a fly on a plane. But here we're talking about the prison population.
Right. And they really have no choice if they want to talk to a friend or family. Which, you know, ostensibly would make them better inmates and better citizens to keep communication with the outside world, and they're being charged, you know, $5 per 15-minute phone call.
And, Mike, here's a topic we've discussed on the show in the past, and anyone who has students, say, in the Boise School District and some others have been receiving email invitations and information about vaping. So what are the latest stats on this? Are more teenagers turning to vaping, or what's the parent response? What's the administrative response?
You know, the story, I think pretty much everybody covered it, but just a couple weeks ago, we had this big meeting with a lot of the administrators, and Ada County shared this stat with us that just like 5 years ago, they had, you know, citations for kids who would light up a cigarette, and they were in the low teens or maybe dozens on a big year. Last year, it jumped up as vaping kind of started gaining steam, so to speak. It bumped up to like 250 or something like that. And then this year already, it's like 433. It's a significant issue at West Ada School District. They are trying to figure out exactly how to stop it. Kids often feel like it's a safer option than smoking. They pick it up. They do it with friends. They think it's – I mean, it is easier to hide than smoking a cigarette. And you can just slip it in your pocket and carry it with you throughout the whole day. And so, yeah, they enabled parents to join this conversation about how do we stop it? How do we remedy kids feeling like it's an okay habit to pick up?
I see. Just a little bit of time left, and I thought we'd go to another political firestorm. Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan was acting governor, of course, that's her role, for part of last Friday. And she kind of set some editorial writers going for what she did. Scott?
Right. So this was Patriots Day. So April 19th is marked as Patriots Day to mark the battles of Lexington and Concord in the American Revolutionary War. And during that ceremony, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan was acting governor. Governor Brad Little was out of town or not in his capacity as governor. And during the ceremony, Janice McGeehan administered an oath, which was taken from the Idaho National Guard oath to members of an armed group who were at Patriots Day. The Lewiston Tribune and the Post Register, our sister paper, wrote editorials really excoriating McGeehan for doing this because it created the image of inciting folks to take up arms against their government. And there were speeches during this Patriots Day celebration that was very much talking about the halls of tyranny.
Clearly, some people responded to that message, but others, as this editorial writer wrote, were pretty outraged. Has the governor responded?
And the governor has not responded. You know, Betsy Russell, our reporter, was at a press conference yesterday and asked him pointedly about this, and he said, "We're not here to talk about that, and I'm absolutely definitely not going to answer your question."
But at the same time, the governor was with Lieutenant Governor McGeehan at a function where he was delegating responsibilities to McGeehan to look for government deficiencies. For Governor Little to act surprised that the question came up and to take umbrage that the question came up is a little bit precious.
Always some politics. I'd like to wrap up our thanks to this week's reporter roundtable, Kevin Richard of Idaho Ed News, Mike Sharp of KIVI 6 on Your Side, and Scott McIntosh of the Idaho Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in to Idaho Matters. Coming up, the story behind a local brand that you will know. This is Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio News.